Okay, I should have said. So we're going to be talking about lung cancer. This is Dr. Strachan, and so as far as lung cancer, it's the second most common type of malignancy in the U.S. among both men and women. Does anybody know what the first one is? For women. Okay, what about for men? Prostate. So this is the second, and what's the third?
Colon,
among both, right? Okay. And lung cancer is also the most common form of cancer mortality in the U.S. in both men and women. In 2007, the U.S. Census showed that approximately 215 new cases of lung cancer were diagnosed, and about 162,000 there were deaths. The incidence over the last about 13 years or so, or 15 years, between 1990 and 2003 has been stable in men. However, in women, the incidence has actually been increasing, and primarily has been increasing in African-American females, more so than in white females. And the majority of the increase in incidence has actually been found in never smokers, healthy and active women, possibly from secondhand smoking or just genetics. And although deaths have begun decreasing in men, mortality in women has reached a plateau. And currently, almost half of all cancer deaths occur in women. About 10 to 15% of lung cancer victims are non-smokers, and among that group, women are about 2 to 3 times more likely than men to get the disease. Median age of diagnosis is 66 among both sexes, and more of the patients under the age of 50 are diagnosed as women. So women tend to get cancer at a younger age, more of the non-smokers get lung cancer, women as more as non-smokers get lung cancer. And although in women, majority of the cancers were adenocarcinomas, in men, majority are squamous subtype. This is just a map of lung cancer distribution within the U.S. And we look southeast, majority of the population with lung cancer were in this area. So what are the risk factors? Number one, two, and three is it's cigarette smoking. So I have it as number one. And although smoking has decreased over time, there's still majority of patients, people are still smoking in society. And some studies suggest that women have more difficulty quitting smoking than men. And risk in smokers of lung cancer increases about 10 to 30 times more than the non-smokers. And smoking more than 25 cigarettes a day has been associated with a higher rate of lung cancer than smoking less than 25 cigarettes a day. However, one thing I was told when I was in med school, and something that I repeat in many different situations, you know, I don't like to say 25 is the cutoff number. You're either smoking or you're not. And I was told in med school, you're either pregnant or you're not. There's no such thing as a little bit pregnant. There's no such thing as a little bit smoking. It's one or the other. So when somebody says they're trying to quit, they're down to, you know, a pack a day for the last 10 years, or, you know, half a pack a day, it doesn't matter, or even 5 cigarettes a day, it doesn't matter. You're smoking or you're not. So the age of onset of smoking makes a difference, because the amount of years you've been smoking makes a difference. The degree of inhalation, the tar and nicotine content, and use of unfiltered cigarettes. Smoking cessation does decrease risk of lung cancer significantly. However, it does not completely go down to zero. So over the years, over about 15, 20 years, the risk will decrease, but it'll always remain higher than the never smokers. Secondhand smoking is a big, big contribution to lung cancer. And here, it's also the longer the exposure to cigarette smoking, to secondhand smoking, the higher the risk. And approximately 17% of all lung cancers in never smokers is due to secondhand smoking. Now, there used to be commercials, I haven't seen them in at least maybe 6 months or a year, maybe 6 months or so, where this woman gets a phone call from school calls the school, says the child cannot go to school because he's sick, he has asthma, and she's sitting there and smoking. Mm-hmm. I mean, asthma, but also, you know, she's at risk in the long term. Let's say, if, you know, you have a child and they live with you until they're 18, 20, 20, let's say, for 20 years, you're exposing them to secondhand smoke, and the risk of lung cancer really goes up, and they did nothing to deserve that. So the ban of smoking in restaurants and in closed spaces does decrease the exposure, but you know, that's, you know, there's still a lot. Actually, there's still places that still allow to do that. Other risk factors include asbestos, radon, arsenic, radiation, polycyclic hydrocarbons, nickel, pulmonary fibrosis, HIV infection, family history, beta-carotene, which we initially were using for chemo prevention, has been associated with a higher risk of lung cancer in smokers and race. African Americans and Hawaiians tend to have higher rates of lung cancer in those who smoke, you know, who smoke more, let's say more than 30 cigarettes a day. Those who smoke just a little bit, the risk is the same. And lung cancer in women is a biologically and genetically different disease than in men. So thus, the genes that in women may be causing women to be more vulnerable to the harmful effects of tobacco smoke. The way the chemicals in tobacco are broken down is different. There's the genes that control cell growth may result in development of lung of cancer, and possibly a decreased rate of repair of the damaged DNA in women can lead to higher rates of cancer. And estrogen itself can possibly directly or indirectly affect cancer growth. Well, we know in some tumors, yes, lung cancer possibly as well. Well, we've actually learned now, and we're still learning about a lot of different malignancies, and we've seen, you guys know about breast cancer, and you have estrogen, progesterone, you also have HER2. You guys know about the HER2 also, right? So we've learned that a significant amount of gastric cancers are actually positive for HER2, and medications such as Herceptin has been found, which is used in breast cancer, has been found to actually aid in the treatment of gastric cancer as well. So we're still learning how to regarding a lot of different cancers and how to give directed therapy, so not to cause systemic complications, and possibly just really direct the proper therapy to the proper patient, not just give them toxic medicine that's just hopefully will kill something. So signs and symptoms of lung cancer is cough, hemoptysis, dyspnea, chest pain, hoarseness, especially in those patients with involvement of recurrent laryngeal nerve, SVC syndrome, and you'll see dilated neck veins, facial edema, plethora, and this is due to the pressure on the SVC by the tumor. Pancol's tumor, we know meiosis, ptosis, and anhydrosis, right? Weight loss and paraneoplastic syndromes, such as hypercalcemia and squamous cell and SIADH in small cell. The SVC syndrome is not necessarily from the lung cancer. You can have various different things that can lead to that. Thrombosis can lead. Lymphoma is a big contributor to development of SVC syndrome. So you really need to know what you're dealing with before you treat. The signs and symptoms may develop over weeks or longer. You can have increased venous pressure leading to edema of the head, neck, and arms, headaches, cyanosis, cough, dyspnea, dysphagia, stridor. And here we have just a picture. You have a tumor sitting on top of the SVC, causing compression and distension of the axillary subclavian and jugular veins. And you could see actually a picture. The one on the right is a little difficult to tell, but the one on the left you could see, you know, neck being widened and skin changes and patients short of breath. We had a patient on 5D that had SVC syndrome about a few months ago. Now, anybody know how do we treat SVC syndrome? What do we do first? You're faced with a patient with SVC syndrome.
Steroids.
Steroids, even though it's something that's the first thing that comes to mind, it's actually, they haven't been found to be very helpful. We do that, but it hasn't been found to be very helpful. So first, if we don't even know what we're dealing with, we need a biopsy, right? So steroids, you can, not really helpful. Most people will say radiation, right? Again, you can if nothing else works, but it's actually also not as great. You can use it as, you know, but the number one treatment is actually chemotherapy. So first you have to see what it is. If it's lymphoma, you treat it as lymphoma. If it's lung cancer, you treat it as lung cancer. And actually it works very fast, and you'll see significant response with the chemotherapy. If it doesn't, somebody's getting worse, then yes, you can use steroids, radiation, but really it's chemotherapy. So first you do a chest x-ray, you'll see some mediastinal widening, CT. You can do a Doppler to rule out a thrombus. Oxygen if somebody's short of breath, or hypoxic, elevation of the upper body. Diuretics can help. Anticoagulation of thrombosis, and you must obtain a biopsy before your treatment. You should obtain a biopsy before treatment because you don't know what you're treating, right? And chemotherapy is number one. And the rest is, you know, steroid benefits unproven. We do that, but... Yeah. If it's lymphoma, it can really help. It's part of the regimen as well. For the other, let's say if it's thrombosis, lung cancer, I don't think the benefits are really significant. And prognosis is just a really, when somebody has been diagnosed with lung cancer and SVC syndrome, that means the prognosis is pretty poor. Less than 7 months, they're saying, really less than 6 months. Pathology, most of the lung cancer are adenocarcinomas, and then there's squamous cell, large, small cell, and other types of mesothelioma, carcinoids, other malignancies. Adeno-CA is more common in never smokers and women, and squamous cell CA, it's just something when you look at the imaging, CAT scans, x-rays, you'll see cavitating lesions. And they're usually centrally located and associated with PTH-related proteins, peptides, and you may see hypercalcemia. The prognosis is somewhat similar, but the treatment varies among different tumors. The reason before, you know, we used to say, okay, you know, to the pathologist, just tell us if it's small or non-small. But now we really need to tell what kind of non-small, because again. In oncology, there's a lot of directed therapy, such as Avastin, which I don't know if you guys, whoever rotated through 5D, knows a little bit about Avastin, and it's a VEGF inhibitor, vascular endothelial factor, growth factor inhibitor. And what it does, it cuts off the blood supply to the tumor. And we used to think we've seen some patients that had some bleeding from the Avastin. We used to think it's the tumors that were central, next to the pulmonary arteries or so, such as squamous cell, because it was central. Later on, we saw patients that were having bleeding that had peripheral tumors. And now, basically, it's found that it's not really the location of the tumor, it's the pathology. And squamous cells themselves tend to bleed. So somebody with squamous cell CA is no longer going to be receiving Avastin as part of their regimen. The staging, there's stage one, you know, 1 through 4 in non-small cell. It's very different to differentiate between small cell. Small cell does not have 4 stages. And here it's based on TNM staging. And the staging always changes. So small cell tumors, these are pretty aggressive type of tumors. Typically centrally located, but, you know, don't have to be. They compromise about 13% of all lung cancers. Everything's about 13-15%. Smoking is a major, major risk factor, and the signs and symptoms just like of any lung cancer: dyspnea, weight loss, cough, chest pain. And majority of the patients with small cell that present to you will be metastatic. Well, will be extensive disease. We'll talk about the staging. And the mets frequently to liver, bone marrow, brain. So one of the things you need to do in the workup initially is get a brain MRI. And overall, the prognosis is very poor. There was a patient that I saw when I was a resident, actually, that came in with abdominal. She said she only had this for about a couple of weeks, few weeks, but she was completely fine up until maybe 3 weeks prior. And she looked jaundiced, her belly was very distended, she looked like she lost a lot of weight. And we said, okay, this has been going on for a while, looks like pancreatic cancer, LFTs are high, CA19-9 was done by I think I picked it up, so somebody did see in 1999 was high, thinking, okay, it's pancreas. Then there's a large mass in the pancreas on the CAT scan in the ER. Okay, this is going to be pancreatic cancer. But this doesn't look like it's been sitting. It doesn't look like it just appeared a few weeks ago. She's probably not telling the whole story. She said, no, it's been only a few weeks. I was completely fine. I was working. I was fine. Don't believe it. So usually if it smells like a duck, it looks like a duck, it's a duck. I mean, it's pancreatic cancer. Did a biopsy, small cell. So, and there's nothing in the lung. So you don't absolutely have to have, lung lesions. But you can have small cell lung cancer. And if a bladder biopsy consists of small cell, it's very typical. But majority of the patients will have lung lesions. And oftentimes it is metastatic at diagnosis. So usually they have a lot of bony disease. So as far as the staging for the small cell lung cancer, there's two stages. And one is limited stage, two is extensive stage. Limited stage, it's basically whether or not the disease that's there looks like it could fit into one radiation field, radiation port. So if you kind of question it, you can ask the radiation oncologist, and they can tell you. If they're extensive, it means it's not going to fit into the radiation, radiation port. Okay. And just another tumor, mesothelioma. We know it's a rare type of cancer. It almost always is caused by exposure to asbestos. But what is the number one tumor that's caused by asbestos exposure?
Squamous.
Sorry?
Squamous.
Like non-small cell. Yeah. Non-small cell lung cancer. So not mesothelioma. So... although there's no association between smoking and mesothelioma, smoking in patients does increase the risk of asbestos-induced cancer. So far, no screening tests, chest X-ray, CAT scan, sputum cytology have been shown to reduce mortality from lung cancer. Whatever they've done so far, one of our fellows is doing a study, doing meta-analysis to just kind of confirm this, but so far, nothing helps. So when somebody's symptomatic, that's when you do it, or just basically encourage them, people to quit smoking or never to start. So for diagnosis, the history and physical, laboratory studies and radiographic imaging, most patients who have symptoms, as well as tissue sampling. You must know what you're dealing with, and if it says non-small cell, you need to know what kind. So you really need, because the treatment does differ. So as far as the imaging, you have a CAT scan, you have pathology. The CAT scan shows a mass, right? And the pathology looks like adenoma. Yeah. What is this? PET scan, PET scan. And basically it looks like there's a lesion that's lighting up. And how's the PET scan done? Anybody know?
Give the patient a marker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it goes to an area that's alive, growing, that's utilizing glucose. So we don't have PET CT here, it's overlapping. It's like a regular, PET scan. And it's basically lighting up where the lesion is. Okay, so the treatment really depends on what kind of tumor the patient has, small cell, non-small cell, what kind of non-small cell, what's the stage of the disease, what's the patient's age, performance status. We really look at the performance status, and we have different ways of judging the performance status. We have the ECOG and Karnofsky. The Karnofsky is like 0 to 100, 100 is good, it's perfect, and you just kind of go down from there, and ECOG 0 to 4, 0, you're spend 100% of the time out of bed, 4, you're 100% of the time in bed, 2 to 3 is where, less than 50% of the time in bed, or more than 50% of the time in bed. We've seen patients that have a poor performance status, they usually don't do well with the therapy, so oftentimes somebody with performance status of 3 or 4, well, 4 definitely we would not treat, but 3 oftentimes we would not. Sometimes the performance status is limited by patient's disease, like small cell. So by treating the disease, oftentimes you can improve performance status. So you can do that. If you're looking at the patient and you're seeing that they're not going to do well, you know, we usually try not to treat. Patient smoking status makes a difference because certain medications have been found to be helpful in never smokers. And patient's preference. Somebody who says, I want to work, I don't want to come in for IV treatments, I just want to take a pill, or looking at the patient, is the patient going to be compliant? If you give them a pill, are they going to be taking the medicine every day? So you don't know. And the options include surgery, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, or combinations. So for stage 1 or 2 disease, surgery is an option. Stage 3, we used to use surgery for 3A after giving chemotherapy and radiation. Now surgery has been shown not to benefit and cause more morbidity later on, more mortality. So, patients should be evaluated by the surgeon. If they're not metastatic, possible resectability, and then later on we can follow with therapy. And we have neoadjuvant or adjuvant. Neoadjuvant, medical jargon. Neoadjuvant means before surgery, and adjuvant means post-op. So some of the medications, we have a lot of different medications that are constantly coming out. But of course, for endocrinologists, there's a TSH. For neurologists, there's the PET CT, TSH, B12 folates, RPR, and the whole thing. For us, it's carboplatin. So for non-small cell lung cancer, one of the therapies that we use is carboplatin and paclitaxel, plus or minus Avastin. Avastin is a vascular growth factor inhibitor that I was talking about that cuts off the blood supply. So we also have various other therapies. It's just oral medicines that are helpful in patients who are never smokers, who have had an OCA, but it's not helpful in squamous. So we really need to know about the patient. We need to know about their disease before we choose the therapy. Carboplatin, we know, can cause some neuropathy, some renal toxicity, a little bit better than cisplatin. Cisplatin can cause auto toxicity, neuropathy, and renal wasting of electrolytes. You'll see significant hypomagnesemia, hypophosphatemia, hypocalcemia, hypokalemia. Sometimes it's very hard to catch up with that, actually. Paclitaxel, neuropathy, and some patients can have leg cramping and pain. So we look at the patient. Is the patient diabetic? They have neuropathy. We choose the therapy for the patient, and we discuss. This is a joint plan with the patients. So, and all of them can cause cytopenias, nausea, vomiting, hair loss, things like that. But now there's more and more targeted agents available. One of the ones that's available in Europe, called Iressa, we have Tarceva here in the U.S. And they've, for example, they compared this oral medicine that you take every day compared to one of the regimens we have, like carboplatin. And we've actually seen that there's really no worse. If you use Tarceva in the right patient, such as, for example, a woman who is a never smoker, has an adenosine OCA, they've actually done very well in, compared to carboplatin and with less toxicity. So you have to really, and especially patients who have EGFR overexpression, you talk to the pathologist, you find information about the patient's tumor, and you direct the therapy towards the patient. Unfortunately, the prognosis is not so great. Even in stage 1 cancers, the prognosis can be 50 to 60% 5-year overall survival. In stage 4, overall survival, they're saying about 9 months. I mean, now it's more about 12 months. That's on the average. You can have patients going several years with the stage 4 disease. Small cell lung cancer, unfortunately, is much worse. And limited disease has a 5-year survival of less than 20%, of about 20%. And extensive disease usually doesn't go past, can go past a year, but usually not. Now the overall, the stage-specific survival is really better in women than in men. They've noticed that actually women who underwent surgical resection disease had longer overall survival than men of the same stage in surgery. Looks like we went through it very quickly. Because I just wanted to kind of just review with you guys. I mean, oncology seems pretty complicated. I mean, I know hematology is a lot more fun, a lot more interesting, a lot more challenging. But with oncology, when, you know, when I talk to people ask me, what do you do? And I say, hemonc, you know, hopefully not something you will ever need, you know. So, since I started, and I'm here for about 2 years now, and so since I went into five, in my fellowship, which is about 5 years ago, just in the last 5 years, a lot of things have happened. I think overall, in oncology, there's a lot of progress. About, you know, more than 10 years ago, about 12, 13 years ago, Rituxan came out, changed the whole treatment of lymphoma, you know, and since then, more and more new things have come out. Gleevec, which we know is a huge, huge progress in CML. Since then, there's other types of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, TKIs, like Gleevec is imatinib, there's nilotinib, there's dasatinib, there's more and more and more coming out. There's in renal cancer, which there was nothing before. Now we have one oral medicine and another oral medicine. Now there's two new ones intravenous that are changing the course of the disease. And now we're learning more and more about the actually the intricate details of each malignancy, and really learning how to target the therapy specifically to this specific patient. And how to avoid systemic complications, how to do really directed therapy, which really don't require pre-medications, no steroids or nothing. They can go on with their life, they can work. And so I think there has been a lot of development in oncology. So if, you know, anybody's interested, you know, I do encourage you guys to, you know, if you guys are interested in fellowships or so, I do encourage you guys, you know, to look into it. But it's just every day there's more and more articles, more and more things coming out saying, okay, you know, now this is great. Now how about this? How about, you know, we're learning about more and more pathways. How do we block this pathway so we don't affect, you know, we don't cause too many complications? And how do we treat this disease? Just like HER2 disease, HER2 in gastric cancer. Who knew? Who knew that Herceptin itself in gastric cancer can make a major difference? Who knew that now, okay, Herceptin came out, now then lapatinib came out, the new drug, somebody who's got a couple of years out of Herceptin that before would not. Now, let's say progress. There's a new drug, an oral medicine, lapatinib. Now somebody who progressed on lapatinib, there's more things coming out. So I think there's a lot of advancement in oncology. In some tumors, less so, like pancreatic, hepatocellular, not so much, but, you know, one thing came out a couple of years ago. But lung cancer, we're just learning more about how to utilize the drugs properly. Avastin was a huge development. People had large pleural effusions and major disease, and addition of Avastin to chemotherapy noted to have a CAT scan from, you know, massive disease, massive effusions to clean lungs. You know, so then we learned that by stopping chemotherapy altogether, including Avastin, we saw some people's disease came back. It's like starving a tumor from blood supply, and then you're taking away that starvation factor, and all of a sudden the tumor has this neovascularization. All this, you know, the tumor starts to grow. So we learned that it's good to actually continue the Avastin afterwards, and so people go on to the maintenance treatment, just keep this quiet for a while. So we're still learning, but. You know, this is it's just just wanted to give you guys a brief overview of lung cancer, a little bit about the background, a little bit about the treatment, the staging, and just how, and a little bit about oncology. But it was kind of finished very quickly, but open for questions. Yeah.
And would you say that sputum cytology and like a smoker with more than 30 pack years that comes with a new cough?
You can, but I don't know if it's going to be, if it's negative, are you going to believe it? If it's, you know.
I mean, it's just fishing for positive. You're not going to do anything for negative. But, because I actually did some work on that as a student, a screening, and yes, there's nothing in the screening, but they, overall, all the reviews did encourage people to look for the simple measures, like such as the cytology, definitely X-ray. They said cytology is very, very cheap. And easy to do, and if someone has many back years, then they have more probability of disease to make it, maybe not like break that.
But is it going to change survival?
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. Yeah. But for each and every individual patient, it might make a difference in their lives.
I mean, we don't know. No, possibly, but if they're symptomatic, so then you then proceed with a chest X-ray or so. And,
oh,
you know.
For sure, X-ray.
Yeah.
So. I don't know. Do we see everybody with cough? I mean, yeah. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I don't know if I would automatically start doing.
This is not screening anymore. I mean, it's like symptomatic. That's why I'm asking.
For screening. Not something that's done right now. I mean, maybe some people are, but something right now, nothing has been proven yet. So,
has there been any like any scores developed for like screening, or have they just been looking at like, you know, for example, just plain X-rays, or have they like a combined screening, like maybe your history versus you know, your symptoms, duration and severity, weight loss, like combined scores, sort of thing.
This has been all in asymptomatic patients. I think it gets very complicated when they start having like minor symptoms. Something like coughing. I'm not still not clear if you have to see these people or not. I mean, I'm not clear. If there's something on X-ray, obviously you see them, but if there's nothing on X-ray.
But when do you go to X-ray? Yeah. You know, that's the thing. Also, who you're saying? How do you prioritize? How do you put these patients in? There's nothing that I know of as far as.
They don't have symptoms.
Like as far as age, years, pack years, and everything. No, nothing like that. So, you know, kind of like we have another tumor, like colon cancer, or somebody who has family history. Okay, you have relatives in two different generations. If you have this and that, then you should get screening. And if you have that, then you should, you know, or you should have a colectomy at this age. There's nothing like that for lung cancer. So,
but I did find this proposed algorithm. I mean, it was 5 years back, but it was saying you could set the cytology if someone's symptomatic, and you could consider proceeding to bronchoscopy. So a flexible bronchoscopy is definitely better than X-ray. I mean, expensive, cytology is not expensive.
You go through X-ray first, and
for sure you go through X-ray first. But
if
they're
symptomatic,
you go on the X-ray more. I'm not likely to make a difference.
Yeah, but if you tell a patient, okay, you're having a scuffle, let's check sputum cytology, okay, you don't have cancer, can you really say that? You know,
no, you can't.
So that's why. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, right now, does everybody check PSAs on patients? No.
What do you do if it's
GU, we send them to GU and
then. You send them to GU for like yearly screening?
No, for like.
Yeah, they do it at the
if they end up going to GU, they will set a PSA.
Oh, but look, prostate cancer is number one.
No, for sure.
Yeah, so basically it's not something that's completely proven that, you know, doing biopsies or doing imaging, doing screening, you're going to pick up something that's, you'll find a lot of incidental findings, you end up doing biopsies, you end up having complications, pneumos, things like that. And then, you know, is this going to benefit the patient, and is there any change in their overall survival after you pick it up? It's more like a lag time bias. So, anyway, anything else? Any other questions I can answer, you guys? Nothing else. Sorry, we just went through this. Just wanted to kind of review this. But if you want, if you guys ever want to discuss the hematology patient that we were briefly talking about, very interesting, we're talking about possible TTP or any hematological cases or any other oncology cases, you know, I'd be more than willing to do that. So anybody has any patients, oncology patients on the floor that...
Oh, yeah.
Are you on the floor? No, no. You have 3B now or no?
Yeah.
Oh, you are.
Many.
You're on 3B? No. No. Do you have many oncology patients? That's what
on
I'm
the
saying.
Regular.
On the regular floor, yeah. Really?
Maybe it's only one active oncology patient. It's nothing, we want to actually consult you.
Oh, I'm on consult this one.
So the patient who had a history of prostate cancer in the past, not necessarily, she had a history with that. We're now coming in with right after 14. And we did a CAT scan, they found multiple masses in the liver. And it's definitely a problem of a small lesion in the left upper lobe. About 1 centimeter, 1.5 centimeter longer. So we wanted to pursue a tissue diagnosis, we called EIR, but they said because lesions are too small.
In the liver or in the lung?
In the liver.
Okay.
We tried to get the, you know, the liver, but the interventional radiology, they were not able. They told us it's too small to catch them.
Okay.
He just read the CAT scan and said probably the lesion in the lung would be also far away from the bronchus, so it wouldn't be really difficult to get the tissue biopsy or the bronchoscopy. But we want to consult with definitely pulmonary whether it's really non-visible or not. But in that case, if you cannot approach both, you know, to get
any tissue, any bony lesions?
No bony lesions, so far, So the CAT scan didn't show any increased mass from the.
But how big is the lung lesion?
The lung is 1.5 centimeters.
So it's like borderline for even CT guided.
Yes, even for CT guided. So it's very difficult to get the tissue diagnosis at this point. So all the question was, you sent some tumor markers.
You're fishing for something.
We are fishing something, exactly. So CA was...
What happened to his prostate CA? Did he get radiation?
He got radiation treatment and he got also chemotherapy. He got surgery and
radiation. No, probably hormonal, if anything.
He got treatment, radiation definitely. And it was not recurring. The PSA had been training down, it was all normal.
So check the PSA. I mean, it helps, but it's not enough.
The PSA, which was normal.
Oh.
So we sent other tumor markers. The CA was elevated, 2300 something. So we have been thinking, could be, he never had colonoscopy. We have been calling GI to get a colonoscopy.
I appreciate you guys doing all this before calling us for consult.
Exactly. We're trying not to be calling before getting all this diagnosis done. So, So we're trying to get a tissue diagnosis, but at this point we're kind of stuck at this point. So, GI actually wants to try to get the US to evaluate the liver mass. So I don't know whether they can get the biopsy to the US and get the tissue biopsy.
The thing is that it would help, I mean, probably not prostate, but it would help to see what it is, because with prostate CA that's metastatic, we still initially, unless it's visceral metastasis like liver and lung, those circumstances we usually start chemo. But overall, still, even if somebody's not symptomatic with visceral, we start hormonal therapy, which is Zoladex. Zoladex, what's Zoladex? Anybody know? It's LHRH agonist. So what we do is somebody who has, you should really be careful, especially in patients who have bony mass. Zoladex is an LHRH agonist. So, and prostate cancer is a hormonally, usually initially, responsive disease. If you start Zoladex, it gives you a spike of LHRH, and then the tumor, wherever it is going to grow. And in patients who have some bony disease that you may or may not see, can present all of a sudden with a cord compression. So before we start anything, we start Casodex, which is an anti-androgen. Protect, kind of put a cover on the tumor everywhere, on the prostate and everywhere else. And during that phase when the Zoladex has this LHRH surge, it's going to protect from that surge. And then over time, the Zoladex actually is an anti-LHRH, right? So it's actually going an LHRH antagonist. So after 2-3 weeks, they become antagonistic, and you could withdraw the Casodex or keep it on, whatever. And you can treat that with them with hormonal therapy. But I don't know if this guy is prostate or what. But usually that's something that we would do.
That's our question at this point. So what else?
If you have no biopsy. The other thing you could do is probably repeat it again in 2 months. This is what oncology usually says. Okay, don't know, can't get a biopsy. If you really cannot get a biopsy, really cannot find a primary anywhere else, repeat it in 2 to 3 months. And then you can.
And then it goes and then it's just
That's usually our thing.
I think you know this patient. Hepatocellular, she was planned biopsy. She had not really...
She's been discharged, right? No? No.
She needs a stent. She has a large hepatocellular mass.
She also has a renal mass and an adrenal mass and a thyroid.
So Dr. Palecchio, what he did was he did an EUS and going down...
Yeah, he's like his sweetheart.
The thyroid, biopsy the liver, biopsy the adrenal, biopsy the kidney.
So that's actually what they are trying to whether they can be
But so she seems to be having a thyroid that's a...